It's
Gentleman Jack Crack.
Cue that fucking jaunty music. Groveling. Good lord. Hey, everyone.
Hey.
Welcome to the very first Gentleman Jack Crack. What do we say? Historical nightcap.
Yes, I love it.
I mean, that's all you. You came up with a nightcap. And even though it's very, very possible, since we know a number of listeners listen to the podcast on their way to work, that it's definitely not night, probably not, as you listen to this. But the general feel, the general vibe of a nightcap is what we're going for here.
Yeah.
When I think of nightcap, I think of booze, but...
I think of good company. I think of the night not being completely over.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that.
Where it's like whether you had some feelings about the day that you want to just sort of sort out before you lay your head down, if it's near the end of the day, or if you're with company, it's like, well, I don't want to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Just yet.
So. That's actually a really good way to explain it, because that's basically what we're doing with these episodes. But yeah, this podcast episode is just a little bit of frosting, historical frosting, as it relates to episode one of Gentleman Jack, entitled I Was Just Passing.
She's just jauntily storming straight to your estate.
Okay, so let's get into it. As the episode started, we see Anne returning to her family estate, and she's not in a good way emotionally. She's emotionally spent. She has just recently gone through humiliations, rejection, and it's not just the best foot to be on, or rather, it's not the best circumstances to be in if you're an enlister and you're just looking for a bae to call wifey. And yet again, some impertinent dick has stolen the opportunity from you.
Oh, I was saddened. That was a rough flashback to sort of experience.
It was. And so I wanted to identify, we mentioned in the first episode that, well, we read the line aloud, the line of Icarus, as we discussed it, as she basically, we paraphrased how she said, she basically flew too close to Icarus and, well, now the bitch is back down to earth. Shabby little shipped in with my shabby little family.
Yes.
Before we actually get into the meat of the entry of what Anne is talking about, earlier in this diary entry on Sunday the 29th in 1932, she writes, in 25 minutes, wrote 3 pages to my aunt to say, now all things considered, thought it best to attend to business concerns, in brackets at Shipden, without further loss of time. Should be at Lawton tomorrow night, would write from there as soon as I could say when to expect me at Shipden. And she continues, beg my father and Marion not to mention expecting me. Wish to arrive unlooked for by all but yourself. And it's interesting because I think because as we have further insight into Anne's interpersonal relationships with her aunt and her sister and her dad, that as it comes across in the show from what we've seen so far, and definitely as what comes across in the diaries, is that she is closest to her aunt. And while there isn't much information known about Anne Lister's mother, and certainly not how she related to her mother or how she thought about her mother, very rarely mentioned in the diaries, but you get the impression that, you know, when she was young, her parents thought she was a handful. But in the few moments that she does write about her mother, it is with affection, even though it's very likely they were at odds at different points in their life, because who wouldn't be with their mom? Especially if you're known to get into a bit of trouble like I was when I was younger, then that's to be expected. But generally, I think she had a decent relationship with her mom. I'm just going to imbue the fact that this Aunt Anne relationship is like the desperately needed replacement. And arguably, potentially, she's gotten much closer to Aunt Anne than she would have gotten to her mom in life because of the fact that she was sent over to Shipden when she was turning up as a young adolescent. Because they're like, I don't know, this bitch got too much energy for me. Please deal with her. What are your thoughts on her line of, you know, her asking her aunt not to mention to her father and her sister that she's coming? She just kind of wants to arrive without any fanfare and say hi to her aunt and then, you know, just go about her business.
I think that says more about her relationship with her immediate family, where I don't know if it's true of your, like, unit, but I know with my siblings, when we get around each other, no matter how far we think we've outgrown petty bonds, shit. We all regress. We devolve. Yeah, we are little kids petty. All over again.
You never fully outgrow
and
petty.
When you have a traumatic moment that you all experience as a tight unit.
Right.
It's like the elephant that's always going to be in the room when you're together. So if you have a dead parent, when you're with your siblings and your father, the only thing you all are going to be thinking about is how to navigate this space so close to one another without mentioning this dead relative that affected everyone severely. And although some may feel more so than others. So to be so close to those kind of thoughts, maybe those were some of the subliminal motivational forces to keep her exploring to, you know, increase her wealth, to be of, you know, I'll do a new family. I'll get a, it's almost, I don't want to say a replacement, because I don't want to sound like that therapist from, oh, you know, that God. Other show where it's like, well, is it intercourse or does she, is she just need a mom replacement? Like,
that's, please,
that's not what I'm doing
here. Don't
take
me back to that head propaganda. I don't need that in my life right now. These listeners do not deserve to hear me yell and scream on this very first historical fucking.
I was so mad.
Nightcap. But I think you're right. I mean, just because existentially and objectively, you know, if you lose a parent or just anyone in your immediate family who's close to you, the likelihood that that person will cross your mind at least once a day, and that's putting it at the bare minimum, is extremely high. For the loved ones I've lost, I was super close, and the friends I've had who've lost, you know, primary and parental units really young, it's just, it's not something you ever get over. It's just something you learn to deal with. And perhaps the pain becomes less obvious or on your face for other people to experience, which makes it easier for them to deal with you.
Yeah.
And your issues, but I don't think that's ever something that you just get over. You just, it becomes manageable. Like grief, you just learn to manage your grief. Right. So I think that's interesting that you brought that up. Okay. And I mean, we'll get into it more in subsequent episodes, but there's definitely a whole lot of petty between Marion and Anne. I mean, they even have an argument where at the end of it, it's like, well, I'll change my will and take you out, bitch. And she's like, well, if you take me out of your will, bitch, I'll take you out of my will. And it's just like, girls, what? Y'all wildin'. But I appreciate that shit. Okay, so to this entry, the full diary entry that has this part that Sally Wainwright and the other creators pulled from to create this scene in the show, it appears in the book Nature's Domain, Anne Lister and the Landscape of Desire by author Joe Liddington. What's interesting about this entry is that, as I mentioned in the first episode, that Lady Gordon is a character, or not a character, but Lady Gordon is a player that comes into the scene after the situation with Miss Hobart, because I don't want to say she's like a backup plan, but she's kind of like a contingency plan. And we kind of learned that Anne had several contingencies she was working on in terms of having a bae. And I just call that learned lesbian experience. Like, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Although she did kind of fuck up with Veer, because it's like, yeah, what was you doing with that straight girl? I mean, that's a reality for her. Veer disappoints her, Veer humiliates her, or she feels humiliated by Veer, and she's like, well, at least I got Miss Gordon. There's sentiment to that fact in the entry of at least I have Miss Gordon. You know, it's probably better anyway. I'm not fucking around with Hobart, wasting my fucking time with this bitch. And so I say that to say that Lady G, which is how she refers to Lady Gordon in her diaries, is mentioned at the beginning of this entry. Okay, here we go. Lady G talked about traveling together, being in the same house but different apartments, etc. In fact, different establishments and independent of each other. I felt myself in reality gauche, and besides, in a false position. I have difficulty enough as to the usages of high society and feeling unknown. But I have 10 times more gaucheries on account of money. And just as a point of reference for anyone listening, gaucheries essentially means awkward, embarrassed, unsophisticated. And so Anne is basically shading herself as she writes her own diary entry. But I have 10 times more gaucheries on account of money. Had I the $5,000 a year Miss H, for Miss Hobart, thought of, i.e. thought I had, I could do. As it is, how can I? Yet there is none, not even M, for Mariana, to whom I can really tell the whole thing as it is. My high society plans fail. Unknown and without connections, money should abound. I have had my whim, tried the thing, and pretty much it has cost me. I shall in future perhaps do more wisely and within my compass. My pride needs not to be much wounded, for none needs guess the truth. M will attribute all, i.e. everything, to my affection for her. Miss H will put it down, in some sort, to my care and disappointment about her. All the rest will never dream it is of want of fortune, and I shall now get out of my scrape as well as I can, and can manage it tolerably. I have been in Icarus, but shall fall less fatally, for I can still live and be happy, Providence being willing. I shall hear what M says, and perhaps may go to Italy with Lady G, and make up my mind not to spend more than I ought to for the present, and then back out quietly. While I have gained experience, Lord have mercy on me. I will eventually hide my head somewhere or other. I have fortune enough for that, and I shall be happier than now. I am glad to have seen Lady G. It has done me good. The mortification of feeling my gaucheries was wholesome. I shall now settle upon something and be better. Yes.
Well, all right.
Thoughts on that entry?
So she's not balling like she wished she was. And she felt like this plan, although it wasn't ideal, it was like, well, you could be my, you know, permanent lady neighbor. which would have been some sort of a forever, but not the forever she had in mind for herself.
Anna's a woman with an evolving plan. And I just sort of feel like, well, she's like a serial monogamist. That's essentially what this is. Like, she craves companionship and the kind of companionship that is 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days
a week. Someone to watch movies with.
She wants to be around women. And it's, I mean, I can sympathize with that, where on the one hand, you're like, wow, leave those straight girls alone. But on the other hand, she just wants to be in the company of women. She's like, well, as long as I'm in the company of a woman who likes me and maybe we can get a little grubble going, then that's what I'm looking for. And eventually, hopefully, she will become my wife, because that's actually what I need, is to have a wife.
By the way, I was joking about someone to watch movies with. There are no movies in the previous era.
You could watch the movie would have been Life. You'd have been like, let's look out this window and just see what's happening in Halifax today. Not much, usually, probably, in Halifax. Oh,
she's a romantic.
Oh. Who, Anne?
Yeah.
Of course she's a romantic. This bitch wore black for 17 goddamn years because a woman broke her heart. If that doesn't scream romantic, dramatic, gay, I don't know what does. You already know about the pubes. I mentioned that to you last episode. So if you didn't know, this bitch was on another level.
I thought I saw pubes and I was like, oh, it wasn't.
You know, I don't even know how to call that wishful thinking. I don't even know what to call it. It's just something. It's you on your palastri in Halifax.
I was like, oh, it's her bookmark.
You know someone's going to listen to the episode and just be like, what the fuck, Terrence? Look,
there was just so much hair.
Hair grabbage.
There was lots of hair. And her hair's usually up. That's the first time you saw her hair down, which usually signifies some sort of, you know, openness.
Oh my gosh.
And I just thought some of the hair was excess and may have been put inside of a book and closed. That's not what happened, but that's what I thought.
I know. And I'm so excited to see other things that you will think as this series wanes on. But yeah, that was ridiculous. I guess, yeah, we'll close out this particular entry of Anne by saying that She
didn't walk out of the situation a winner, but she's not going to lose all of the face.
You know what? She's an optimist.
Yeah.
That's what it is that, and that's what I can, and actually, I mean, there's a number of things I can relate to pretty intensely with Anne Lister, especially the more times I watch the show, I'm just like, oh, there's another thing, another personality thing. And one of those things is this, what we just said, optimism. Because, I mean, that's something that can be said for virtually her entire diary, with the exception of certain parts where she was depressed for longer periods of time. And even in her depression and her sadness and frustration and disappointment, humiliations, she always kind of at the end tried to be like, well, you know, things can always go up from here. Tomorrow's a new day, new opportunities for shit to happen. And gosh, I was about to say a line from episode 2, but you've not seen it yet. But you know what? For those of you who've already watched it, you probably know where I was about to go with that line, but I guess we will address it when we get there. Okay. So in the same section of the book, Nature's Domain, they expand a little bit further after that entry on what is happening at that time between her and her women, Miss Hobart, Lady Gordon, and of course, Mariana Lawton. This excerpt gives some indication into her shitty feelings, her depressed feelings about her social circle after suffering this issue with Miss Hobart, where she wrote, "Musing on my failure, resolved to give up all fine society schemes and planning what to do, may never see Miss H or Lady G or any of them again. We'll talk to M. Settle on fixing at Clermont or Grenoble. Have a house and a garden and a study and be out of the way of English people." Lady G's proposal to be independent of each other opened my eyes. She would not be bothered by having me to society for in Florence. I may bury myself somewhere in comfortable seclusion and study, and then I shall have fortune enough for happiness. This determining did me good. What a change in all my plans and thoughts since this day fortnight. Donald's offer and its being accepted changed all, but I am already convinced it is for the best. So there's another example of her, you know, at the same time being like, God, fuck my life, fuck the situation, fuck everything that's going on with Vera Hobart, but also, it's probably for the best. She's talking herself into the shit. She's like, bitch, I didn't even get a grubble. I barely got some kisses and some good conversation. And move the fuck on. In this chapter, the book goes on to mention that Anne's visit to Mariana, which I believe I mentioned a little bit of in the first episode, where I just sort of was like, we see a Mariana visit to Shibden after she returns back to Halifax off her shit after being at Icarus, and that it doesn't go well as we analyze. Like, they fuck, but there's so much baggage. There's so much fucking unspoken water under the bridge that there's really no hope for romance there. And if romance was there, it was there like 10 years ago, but it's not there now.
Yeah, I don't think any of us were meant to feel comfortable with the way how we just get into our feelings when, you know, Lady M decides to eviscerate potential realities, potential future, potential dreams.
Are you talking about Mariana when she's tearing her apart?
I was like, ugh.
Like Lucy Liu and Kill Bill. Tear the bitch apart! I feel like that's the devil that's in Mariana's head. Like, there's an angel and the devil, and the angel's like, thank her for the thank her for the vigorous grumbling. And the other side is like, tear the bitch apart! You're bitter, you're upset. And she always chooses the devil. Okay, so the book mentions that Anne's visit to see Mariana did not go well either, much like her interactions with Lady Gordon. And says that Mariana's reception to her was cold and that she was preoccupied with her local philanthropy and family affairs. And the book is like, indeed, rather like comfortably old friends, the two women now spent much time discussing their wills. Mariana talked about how she could not leave Charles, who might live for another 20 years. And by comparison, Anne's whimsical travel plans and unsettled state were becoming increasingly visible. Even conventionally married Mariana suggested that, quote, I should be more happy and settled than wandering as I do now. So Mariana was out here throwing shade. She was like, you wanderer, wandering wisp. Is that a phrase? Wandering wisp. Did I just invent that? We'll go with it. I don't know why, but I just got this vision of a fae, like a hipster fae. And I don't even know what, it might be the time, it might be the coffee. None of what I just said makes any sense. But at the same time, it makes perfect sense to me. I didn't even give you a chance to answer. I answered my own question. But yes, so, I mean, Mariana out here being shady, but considering how we saw her in the first episode, Mariana's a shady bitch. The book mentions that it was during this unsatisfactory visit to Mariana that was the final nail in the coffin for Anne's high hopes and social ambitions. Because evidently she had this scheme referred to in the book as the Dame de Compagnie, which is basically Anne's plan to run away with a hoe. Like, that's literally what she does, is that she wants to travel and experience life and go on little adventures and also get a little grubble in with a pretty lady, preferably a pretty lady of social standing. And so even as this plan with Hobart crumbles, boom, nothing's happening with Hobart. Okay, what's up with Lady G? Boom, Lady G is acting funny style and I don't have enough money to travel in separate quarters, which is not what I'm into anyway. And then we find out as the reader, when you read these books, that she had this scheme, the Dame de Compagnie, and she basically was like, I need a hoe, any hoe. And she was writing to her friends, including Mariana, to be like, do you know of a woman who might travel with me on trips? And what was interesting about this is that she even suggested that she would employ this woman. And I mention that because we're getting to the weird waters of why it likely did not work out amongst her friends, because we were like teetering on prostitution in the sense that she's like, I need a lady maid, but not a lady maid that's just going to be my servant. She needs to be my companion. And
yeah, I can see the prostitution.
And that's not to
lie.
Say she would be like, I'm forcing you to go with the grubble. Right. I don't think Anne was about that. She was very clearly about consent, because every step of the way with Anne Walker and God with Veer, like, she waits for permission to be like, can I do this? Do you want this? Let me confirm that you want me. But in this situation, it's sort of one of these situations, and I'll get to an excerpt where, you know, she's just throw names in a hat. You know, she's like, who do you know? Who do you know? Who do you know? And of the people Mariana eventually recommends as this companion to go with her is one of her sisters. And I mentioned you before, and I don't know if we'll get into it this episode, probably another episode, because I mentioned to you how Anne really fucked around with all of Mariana's sisters. And I'm like, was that petty? Was that revenge? Was that just super gay drama, all three, all of the above, all together? 1830s or just 19th century L word? Like, what the fuck? Anne's chart of like connections, lesbian connections, is ridiculous just within the family tree of what she was doing. But wow. At the same time, yeah, I don't. If you're like, does the queer run in the family? Let me find out. But yeah, that was Anne. She was a très confidante. Huh. So that's a thing. So with that said about the companion scheme, what was going on? The book also mentions in this part that this translated literally as lady companion, but it carried a rich set of social nuances. Not quite a servant, not quite like a governess, yet not a social equal, as the companionship had to be paid for. And with Anne Lister's reputation among her female friends, it carried additional possible meanings. However, Mariana, perhaps feeling sympathetic to Anne's low spirits, responded helpfully to the scheme. She offered her own sister, Louisa Belcombe, for the post, and even agreed to write to her, but conspiratorially, as if the suggestion had not originated from Anne. So there you have it. Mariana, like, what about my sister? My sister likes the sapphic troubles. It runs in the family. Also, what the fuck was Mariana on? Now, I'm going to go, honestly, the more I've thought about Mariana, just as like a person, as a queer woman, I've had more and more thoughts. And part of me wonders if this wasn't like another aspect of her trying to control, and I don't necessarily want to say sexual experiences, but sexual entanglements in a way.
Well, if she's to count herself among the, I don't know, trifled, tiddled with, you know,
Mariana?
I would say that she was looking to maintain a short leash to express happiness without the commitment versus...
You mean Mariana?
Her, yeah.
You think that's Alyssa, why she would suggest her sister? Because, yeah. Okay. Because that's what, I mean, I think it's like keep your, not even the phrase keep your enemies close, but like this weird controlling thing of, I still want to say in who you end up with.
Well, no, but yeah, you're right with that. It's like, I don't want to actually give you an actual recommendation with someone you could actually be happy with long term, because how does that benefit right. me in the end?
And Mariana doesn't actually think that's possible. She doesn't think there's a bitch out there that's willing to.
And those are the things you say to people that you want to just keep from breaking, shattered the ceiling, if you will.
That makes
because
sense.
She's trying to obviously live this unconventional life. You know that she's not ordinary and you'd be miserable without her in your life. She's the one thing that makes you interesting.
I love how we're going to have all these fucking Killing Eve references because we can't fucking help ourselves. But for all of our lovely listeners who followed over from one podcast to this one, hopefully you're laughing with us. Yeah, all of that, what you just said.
It's kind of fucked up. I mean, no, I don't want to think that way about her yet.
It's not even about wanting, you know, it's about contortions. It's really about contortions because Mariana was more likable to me. By the way, I mean, I told you, but the audience, the listeners do not know that I read 3 more books since I recorded episode 1 with you and was like, I read 5 books. And so, Mariana's a gaslighter. Like, I have empathy for Mariana. I can understand why she would make the decisions she would and be bitter and cowardly in certain situations where it is to be expected given the time and what's happening. But at the same time, she's a fucking gaslighter. At the same time, I'm really hot and pissed off that 18 years passed, 19 years passed, basically 20 years fucking passed, bitch. And you still calling on a bitch? You still writing a letter when you know the type of agony you've caused her? I mean, if we go back, as we will, as we get more into the things with Ann Walker and we reference some of these diary entries where she's absolutely just devastated and hurt and suffering no. because Mariana is married to a man and they committed to each other and they were gonna, you know, the idea of marriage and lifelong commitments was first established when they were talking to each other, and suddenly Charles comes and it can't work anymore, and eventually because of letters and suspicions and whatever, they can't write to each other anymore, there's not contact, and Anne is just off suffering by herself. Just sort of like, I'm alone, I have no companionship, I'm fucking depressed, and maybe I'm still flirting with women here and there, but I'm completely and totally emotionally obsessed with Mariana. While Mariana's over there living her married life. And we don't have like any sort of, you know, intricate insight into what Mariana's thoughts were. And so I can't ever be sure of how she felt for Anne and if where the realness is where that's concerned. But as far as the information we've been given and what I can glean from the situation, my stance is that she never intended to leave Charles. She never had any true idea or belief that her and Anne could live a happy life together separately in a house, despite what society says about women getting married, because it was something she never did. And she leads Anne on all these years because she's selfish, because she loves a good grubble, and there's not many women she knows, if any others at all, who would grubble her down like Anne does. And so she keeps that bitch here tethered. Let me give you a little something every so often to reignite this passion, to make you think that there's an opportunity and a chance, because that's basically what we see Anne vocalizing in the 20s, in the 1820s. Maybe there's still a chance. I believe there's still a chance. Oh, I feel bad about being disloyal to Mariana or having this flirt or this interaction with another woman because, no, this is what we're supposed to do. Yeah, there's still a chance. I still have hope. I don't dote on anyone else the way I dote on her, etc. Until she gets to the point after, you know, the 2 major incidences where she's like, you know what? You're never going to leave Charles. This is never going to happen. And you just want me here. Like the line we referenced from episode 1. Oh, you're happy for that. But then you're back to your fucking man in the fucking morning. And I'm not down. I'm not into it at this particular moment. I already had my one grumble and it's done. And so my position on Mariana is that she's fucking selfish. She's toxic. We can empathize with why she is the way that she is and how she has become this woman. But it doesn't change the fact that she is this fucking woman and not entirely likable to me at all. One of the other funny things I enjoyed about Nature's Domain in the very beginning were the details of Anne's arguments with Marion when she got back, because for all intents and purposes, it's just like the show, obviously not verbatim or word for word, but the sentiment of we're arguing. Like, you just got here and I got shit to say, actually. And so basically the book describes, you know, from Anne's perspective, that when she got back, they were arguing about things like church pews and stuff like that. And then it got to more contentious topics like will writing and who would leave the other sister. What, if anything at all? And here's a diary entry along those lines. Long talk with Marion. She will not leave me anything. I shall go and make my will and not name her. Went to my room at 4, wrote 3 pages to M. My mind is forever wandering to other subjects. The reform bill and its early omened fate. All that would have interested me so deeply is brushed off from my mind as easily as dust from polished steel. And the sight of my will made, i.e. completed, will give me more pleasure than anything else. And this other half of the entry has to do with the Dame Compagnie scheme, or the companion scheme. And she continues, asked to hear from her, if she has any chance of hearing from her sister, Louisa. Sometimes I fancy this scheme interests me, then I care not for it one straw. I think I cannot remain here long, but the air of my own native hills has done me good. And in spite of fate, the shades of Shibden have still some charm for me. Ever my dearest Mary, very especially and entirely yours, A.L. So that's how she was signing her letter to Mariana. And quite frankly, these bitches go back and forth. There's some back and forth with Ann Walker and the thing. And I think it's actually very sweet and tragic in the ways that it can be as the show progresses. But at the same time, I'm like, bitch, you back and forth. Like, you was annoyed with the back and forth with Ann Walker, but look at your back and forth with Mariana. Literally 20 years of back and forth, 20 years of oscillating of I hate a hoe. I can't stand a hoe too. I wish a hoe was here. I wish I could spend time with this. I wish we could run away together. Or I wish we could grumble. Just a little grumble. Like, she is all fucked up. Mariana got this bitch fucked up, is what I'm saying. She got to cut the hoe from her life. She got to.
I guess it's easier when you're under something new to get over the old. But when you don't even got a new, it's like...
Well.
It's, you just in need. So.
In need. But what's also noted in the diary is that, or in this particular book about Anne Lister, Nature's Domain, is that Anne was also full of lies when she was writing to Mariana. The book specifically says that she piled on subterfuge after subterfuge, which is essentially lie, lie, lie some more. I'm lying again. I'm misleading you into what is actually happening because I can't tell you the truth. And so for the people who think that perhaps there's something more real with Anne and Mariana than potentially Anne and Anne Walker of House Parched, that's ridiculous. What this diary shows to us is that Anne was a very private person at the end of the day, and that she kept a lot of cards close to her vest with everyone, including the person, presumably prior to Anne Walker, that she was closest to or felt that she had the most intimate connection with, shared the most amount of intimacy, would be Mariana. And even then at this time, she's like, I can't tell Mariana this. I can't be honest with her about this. I can't let her see me in this way. And I think that's very telling about the relationship and how Anne regarded her relationships in a certain kind of way, in that she was like, well, I can't be this honest because, well, then it's all belly up. And it's kind of sad and tragic, but I guess poignant for the times that most of this insecurity revolves around money and appearances. For a woman so confident and so intelligent that still she's like, can't let them know I don't got my bread though. Can't let them know I don't got my bread up. Can't let them know that's happening. There's a bunch more entries around this time that basically show Anne still being just in the dumps and depressed. And Mariana actually playing funny style with the companion scheme. She is sort of like not being as helpful as she could be. And Anne is trying not to seem thirsty about like the details, because she's itching to travel again. She can't stand being back at Shibden. She can't stand the stagnation. And I wonder, part of that doesn't have to do with the fact that she's so in process. Like, everything about Shibden and Halifax is backward. And everything about everywhere else she goes is forwards, including finding a wife. And she's like, how could I find a wife here? How could I find an option here? Which is hilarious, given her fucking neighbor, little Miss Anne Walker.
Yeah, I think that has a big part to do with it as well. I mean, I still stand by, you know, she does want to even think of like other personal things and be around family. But yes, being exposed to the world and then going back to your little town, such a quiet village, it's like
You don't need this. You see yourself as bigger than this. You see yourself as above this. You see yourself as smarter than this. So even though you have a business that you're trying to actively run, you're trying to actively run it, you know, annexed or like out of the country, looking for more connections, potential more suitors. You're looking to expand and grow and explode. And you feel that you can't explode at home. It's like, wow. Home's crowding your style.
Home is definitely crowding her style. And we have this next entry here where it basically, let me just read it. A letter from Lady Stewart, all against my dame de compagnie scheme. Thinks half maid and half companion will never do. Says Lady Gordon seems disappointed that my plans are so unfixed. And written in code, she has, perhaps after all, Lady G and I will get together. And your optimism is truly inspiring. It's inspiring, girl, but what? And really what I wanted to read was what was written underneath here by Jo Linnington, where she's like, the opposition to her dame scheme that Anne Lister now encountered was, after all, hardly surprising. Her friends knew her reputation only too well, and the scheme, with its notion of paid companionship, was an undignified blurring of class lines for a woman in their social circle. Well, damn.
I mean, I'm pretty sure even then every woman wanted to be an honest woman, so there's that.
Every woman? No. My obnoxious laughter will never, it will never end. Never.
I'm pretty sure the women she was trying to pick up were all women who seemed themselves as, I don't know, established, dignified.
That's all Anne was into. She was like, are you rich? Are you got culture? Saying, like, are you powerful and important?
Do you feel like going on an adventure?
My undies are spoiled at this moment. Oh, wait. It's fucking 1832.
This seems to be a bit of moisture under my frock.
It's a bit of moisture under my frock. It's a bit like Sunday morning dew under there. I'm actually basing that off of an entry that popped into my head where it's just from the future where Anne is talking about a night of vigorous scrubbing comments how the sheets are moist like the morning dew. So that was literally me channeling an entry, but I was like, all right. Out here trying to go for the gold in 1832. I respect it, ladies. I feel like I was about to Google something. And then I went off on a tangent and the Google stopped.
All right. What were we talking about? We said something about, we did a morning dew. A gander underneath me frock.
I was supposed to do 19th century men's underwear. I want to know what it's called. Men's underwear or undergarments.
I mean, it could be bloomer. Name. It could be a bloomer. Stocking.
Really?
Could be just stockings.
I don't know. Really? Just stockings to hold the frankenberries? That don't seem right. That don't seem right.
Long John stockings is why I'm thinking maybe men didn't have undergarments.
You know they had undergarments. Because they even say on the show when they say Anne Lister's wearing. All right, this says loincloths in ancient Greece. That's, I'm upset.
They just had a pelt just hanging in front of their shame.
Let me go to the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, Western men's underwear became looser fitting. The loincloth was replaced by loose, trouser-like clothing called braise, which the wearer stepped into and laced or tied around their waist and legs at about mid-calf. Wealthier men often wore chusses as well, which only covered the legs. By the time of the Renaissance, braise had become shorter, also giving way to long-form fitting hose.
Pantyhose. It is pantyhose. It's hosiery.
Braise.
It's like the lambskin version of hosiery.
Were also worn with hose when very short doublets. Ugh. You know, I'm so glad I wasn't a man in the 18th century or the 19th century or the 17th century.
That seems all the uncomfortable.
I just don't.
And then if they were hairy too.
But also like the Caribbean in me jumps out because I'm like, that's too much clothing. Like how your underwear a whole other outfit. That doesn't seem
I would have been the shameful person of my era. Have you no shame?
I already know that you put Candace back in time. I'm dead. I'm going to do my misandry and get fucking strung up or like, you know, burnt at the stake.
I'm going to eat a poison berry and then my...
This demon.
My appendix is going to need to be removed, but...
Oh, true. That's if we make it because the minute we have a sip of anything or a piece of bread, stomach's like...
Yep.
It's over. It's like for anyone who just travels for the first time and you just go to a country that, you know, doesn't have the same just habits that your country has for doing stuff like, you know, pasteurizing milk or, you know, putting hormones or not, or modifying their fruits and vegetables or not. And you're just used to certain things. And then you eat things in other countries and you're like, what's this? Death comes soon because my stomach feels like I'm about to die. Essentially, and mostly to save face, I think, was basically like, yeah, fuck the scheme. The scheme's off. You girls are right. I don't know what I was thinking. But it's mostly because the scheme wasn't working out. And Mariana was shading her and Lady Gordon was shading her. And she was like, honestly, I just wanted to travel with a pretty girl, but I'm getting all this fucking shade. So forget it. The book mentions that Anne had become something of a figure of fun among her friends in Yorkshire. In a letter to Vere Hobart, she assured Vere that she had quite done with the Dame de Company scheme. She did not think that, quote, much real pleasure is to be had from bought society. Well, girl, some pleasure. Some pleasure is to be had, but you're all about saving face, and so we get that. So, yeah, we went on a kind of ridiculous tangent to determine what 19th century men's underwear was called in Europe, potentially at this time. And we think it was called brace.
Or, you know, pantyhose.
I prefer pantyhose. The book also continues, generally Anne lamented the passing of traditional ways, confiding to Isabella's younger sister, Norcliffe, Charlotte, about the, quote, humbug of life. I had less independence than ever. The same people and things did not give me the same pleasure as formerly, end quote.
Oh, poor girl. Going through the motions.
Truly. Don't she really do got to go through the motions, because polite society in this time is all about being fucking polite. So even though your bitch left you or decided to marry a dick, you're out here still writing letters to be polite. See, I'm not about that life. That's exactly why I couldn't exist in that century. Oh, let me just send you an honorific email congratulating you on your fucking marriage.
I'm not wasting my good penmanship on you.
No, but she's worried about how it would look on her because of the whole fucking nonsense of quote-unquote polite society. And so you must write your letters and feign that you are indeed happy and pleased for your previously heteroflexible friend who has now relegated herself to a life of mediocre sex and no more grubbling. Because I just feel like only one out of every 30 dudes grubbled their wives in 1832. And that's being generous. Should say one out of 3,000is probably the more accurate situation.
Right. One of 455. Because
they're just like sticking this dick in for an heir. Right. Woman, that's all you're good for.
What? No, yeah. A daughter? You dare disgrace me like this? Smack some more.
And that's why we love Mr. Washington, because that bitch got several daughters. A handful, a literal handful of daughters. Oh my gosh.
She was like, you want to try again, hon? No? Okay, I understand.
And this part of the book that's sort of relating to like the drama with the Bellcombe sisters is ridiculous. And it's talking about Anne just sort of like writing to Vere and things about her marriage settlement and how things are progressing in that way. And just sort of how it cemented ideas she already had in her mind for years that like marriage is the way to just sort of avail yourself to a new level, to rise, to ascend and to have more things and more security and all that stuff. And it's kind of a bit jealous that it's happening for Vere. Because it's happening for her, but also because it's not happening with them together.
Right. Like, what about companions? Our plans? Our come up. I know it wasn't a
Vera was like, what plans? What I said? She's like that gift. She's like, who said that? Who said that about plans? I didn't say that. Did I say that? I think you misunderstood. This one section is like, the following day, Anne packed up and took, quote, inventory of my books. On Monday, she left for York and the Bellcombes. Knowing her predatory reputation, both mothers, first Mrs. Bellcombe and now Mrs. Northcliffe, had to keep an eye on the enthralling Anne Lister. Hide your girls, wow. Hide your daughters, hide your wives. Yo, they're basically saying she was the literal definition of hide your daughters, hide your wives for fucking Yorkshire. I'm into that. That's all I'm saying. I'm okay. I'm okay with that reputation that she was given, even though it meant that she was not getting her bitch. They were not going to go on their travels. That's okay, though, because that made space for Anne Walker later on in the story. And it's fucking entertaining as fuck. And I also just wanted to point out one of these entries that she made from when she was separating with Mariana post the season of Anne Walker starting. And she wrote, walked with M down my walk and by Well Royd and got to Stump Cross Inn. Saw M into her carriage and drove off for York. And this part was written in code. I walked off, musing for a while in Upper Bray Lane and saying to myself, well, the less I think of and care for her, the better. So, you know.
She was through. Caught up.
She was caught up, but through, but still caught up. You see the vibe I was trying to say. Yes. Like she real caught up. All these entries really just cement what we were saying in episode one, that she was just not a happy Anne. She was depressed. She was forlorn. She was many times uncharacteristically unenergetic. And that's something, you know, we see from the jump in the show, that she's a fast walker. She's a fast mover. She's a fast thinker. And it isn't long that she wants to be still in anything. Maybe not still in her thoughts, not still in her actions. And for the first time in a while, with this Hobart situation, she's just deflated in every sense of the word, and not really herself. And obviously, the writers and creators of the show take a degree of creative license with timelines and what's happening here. But I really feel like they got the overall sentiment of what Anne Lister was experiencing when she comes back to Shibden, which to me makes it even more great and even more beautiful experience when Anne Walker comes to the picture, because as we said, she, like, everything about her face and her countenance is dreary, it's droopy, it's sad and depressed. And the minute Pretty Blonde shows up in her crib, she's like, you know what? Like a true gay, like a true lesbian, she's like, you know, I'm so fucking sad. Like, I can't even, how will I go on? Wait, is the new pretty girl in the, let me flirt. Let me get back on my flirts. Let me see what's happening here. And it's what she needs. And I mean, I'll get more into this, but one of my major things about this pairing, now that I have spent copious amounts of time reading about Anne Lister, because I was just like, I need to know all the things. I need to know the context of the things so I can have my own opinions. Thirsty, little thirsty Anne Walker is exactly what she deserved. And when I say that to mean that imagine for the most recent number of years, at least anyway, that you are interacting with people who don't even know how to show you desire. Not really. Right. Like unabashed desire. Yeah. A desire that's not a joint. Reluctancy. Like fucking Hobart. Bitch, don't. When she was trying to kiss the Nate, because I mean,
that was mean. You know,
that was mean. I'm sorry. What was I just saying? I completely lost my train of thought again.
That she deserved.
That she deserved Thirst McGurst.
Yeah.
Thirsty Anne Walker of House Parched, because it's kind of what any, you know, good gay deserves. If you've been pining, like fucking pining. And the fact that you were talking yourself into this shit, you literally talked yourself into this pairing, because you're like, she's got what I need. She's got money. She's got status. She's got the stuff that I want, that this is what I'm going to be into. And then by happenstance, when you're not paying attention, when you're not looking for it, a girl comes into your orbit who has actually been in your orbit before. And you don't have to play all those games. Essentially, Anne would have run off to run away to go traveling again if she could, but she didn't have the bread, so she didn't. And she was back at Shibden and eventually turned her sights to renovating the place and making it prettier than it was. Many of which remain for all those lovely people who are visiting Halifax and Shibden Hall, because tourist things have totally shot up, as it should, for the fucking very estate. Nice. Yeah. I'd like to check it out one day. Here's an example of one of those ridiculous polite society notes Anne would write. Tuesday, July 31st. Wrote to Lady S. De R., which is Lady Stuart de Rolfe. Congratulations on Miss H's marriage today to Donald Cameron Esquire. Never match seemed made with fairer prospects of happiness, etc. I love what she puts, etc. In the diary, like, etc., etc., etc.
You know, those
head stuff, head stuff. Right. You know, those stuff. And then it's like, Anne sent letters in similar vein to Lady Stuart and others. It was at this inauspicious moment that Mariana Lawton happened to travel again through Halifax. And it was a fairly low-key visit, from a diary entry. Told M, Miss H was married today to Cameron Younger of Lochiel, but she made no remark. Mentioned they're going abroad for the winter immediately. Skimmed over the courier, then in code, very civil and kind and attentive to M. And walking home, she seemed to take rather more interest about things than she did before. Got into bed as soon as I could. Not much conversation. She was in pain from her inflamed ear. I hope your ear's inflamed, because we're talking about you in 2019, Mariana. So July ended, and still feeling that she had sunk very low with not only Mariana, but also now with Veer married. Girl, just leave these bitches alone. Journal entry.
Ouch.
Yes. In code. A pretty good kiss on getting into bed, and another about a half hour later. She nothing loth. Lay about an hour talking this morning. She talks of if she sees me not at all. But I avoided making any unpleasant remark, and all went off well. Mariana being a bitch again? That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
And the book mentions that Anne was relieved when Mariana drove off from Halifax. It was an intimacy neither woman could finally say goodbye to, but Anne knew that the relationship had little real future.
good day to that stuff. But okay.
It's a good day to Mariana. Look, there will be more to be said about Mariana, but my God, what a fucking, like a black hole. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Just someone that, like, nothing positive comes out, no light comes out, just sucks all the goodness and happiness from the room. And even if you get a little grubble, is it worth it? No, Terrence, yeah. The grubble isn't worth it. Anyway. There's also an interesting section in the book, The Secret Diaries of Miss Anne Lister, which is the accompanying book for the show Gentleman Jack, that talks a little bit about young Anne and her general relationships with other people, other women, potential friends, especially those in her town, her hometown of Halifax. It says she moved as little as possible in the limited social milieu of the small Pennine town of Halifax, and she often disparaged the rather unsophisticated female company available to her. She began to get a reputation as a snob and a loner, and people began to resent her standoffishness. At the same time, they stood in awe of her undoubted intellectuality and her reputation as a blue stocking. As the Listers were of very good social standing in the town, it was deemed a compliment if one could be on, quote, calling terms with them or include them as guests at social gatherings. There was a great rivalry amongst the young ladies of the town to be counted as an intimate friend of Anne Lister. Uh-huh. That sounds like another miniseries okay. I want to watch, but okay, I'm into that. And it continues, however, Anne, except for one or two instances, refused their offers of friendship. Her emotional life was closely involved with Mariana Lawton, who was now married to Charles Lawton of Lawton Hall, whom she refers to as M in the journals, as we know. The two women had enjoyed a deep friendship and sexual liaison for a number of years. Originally, they had planned on their future together, but M had married Charles Lawton, who is referred to as C in the journals, a man much older than herself and a widower, who was rich enough to give her a comfortable style of life. Anne was and remained deeply hurt at M's betrayal, but despite this, continued the relationship in the hope that C would die, leaving M
with all of his stuff,
right? Leaving M a young widow with perhaps one or two children. The two women would then combine fortunes and lives and bring up the children together. Oh, that sounds, it's the Gaby, uh-huh. Killing Eve flashbacks, but yep. Yes. However, in January 1817, C, Charles, had found a letter from Anne which hinted at this arrangement, and he became extremely jealous and suspicious of her. Well... This put obstacles in the way of the woman's friendship, but despite this, the two carried on a correspondence and were able to meet from time to time, although it was not possible for Anne to visit M at her home at Lawton Hall. M's family, the Bellcombes, however, lived in York, and Anne was a regular visitor to their home when M contrived to visit at the same time. And so this is from The Secret Diaries of Anne Lister that focuses more so on what happened with her in the early 1800s, like 1816, 1817, going into the early 1820s, which of course encompasses her life with, or just influences of Eliza Raine, of Mariana Lawton, Isabella Northcliffe, and others. I'm sorry.
What
I'm
just trying to popular lady.
I'm trying to figure out I'm trying to picture like the 19th century version of like an old het like Charles finding some saucy letter, because what is that letter? Like, can we have that letter? I need to research to see if that letter exists and like if it can be found, because I just want to know what the rhetoric is that caused Charles's dick to shrivel up and cause a fight with Mariana.
Just something like, oh, I can't wait till, you know.
Is this why you don't make any noise ahead when we have sex?
Right.
Because you're not having any fun.
Well, I mean, you've never asked me what I wanted in this bed, and we've shared this bed for years.
I'm sorry, Terrence, that wasn't a concept in the 19th century. Just do away with it. Right. Ask a woman what she wants. I'm sorry. Absurd. Motherfucking Mariana. There was also another interesting diary entry from this book that gives some more insight as we move on. And then so you especially can have some just additional shit as I do. I feel like I have so much information. For as the show progresses and we see the relationship develop with Anne Walker in particular, to have all this relationship background of her and Mariana and how different or just uniquely separate it is, to then give us, you know, further context and insight into why the courtship that happens between the two Annes happens the way that it does. 1,000 reflections and recollections crowded on me last night. The last time I slept in this room and in this bed, it was with Mariana in 1815, the summer of, and the rest of this is written in code. Surely no one ever doted on another as I did then on her. I fondly thought my love and happiness would last forever. Alas, how changed. She has married a blackguard for the sake of his money. We are debarred all intercourse. I am not always satisfied with her. I am often miserable and often wish to try and wean my heart from her and fix more propitiously. There seems little chance of our ever getting together, though I believe she loves me as yet exclusively. The misfortune is my confidence is not invulnerable. Oh, I am suffering.
My poor lady.
So you'll like this entry, this next entry that is relevant to episode one. And it has to do with the original memory that Anne Lister jotted the fuck down in her fucking diary as it relates to the story we heard in episode one where Anne Walker relates it to the Priestleys. That, oh, have you ever met Anne? One time. I'm super excited. Let me tell you about the story. Okay, she came to call at my house and it was amazing. So I just wanted to throw this out there for people who've already seen that episode or just looking for context as to, did Anne Lister write down this memory of going to Anne Walker's house? And if she did, what did she say? Well, we're going to tell you what she said. God damn it. This is from the year 1821. So it reads, Tuesday, the 12th of June, Halifax. At 10 3/4, Miss Rawson, Catherine, and Miss Crackenthorpe called and stayed half hour. Miss Rawson to say that it was Whitsuntide week. Her father and mother did not like her to be out and hoped we should excuse her coming this evening. In the afternoon, at 5 1/4, walked along the new road and got past Pump when Miss Anne Walker of Crow Nest overtook me. I just love the way she wrote that, overtook me. Like, I can picture it right now. Having run herself almost out of breath, walked with her as far as the Lydgate entrance to their own grounds and got home at 6:40. And then this part is written in code. Made myself, as I fancied, very agreeable and was particularly civil and attentive in my manner. I really think the girl is flattered by it and likes me. She wished me to drink tea with them. I hoped for another walk to Giles' house, and the readiness she expressed shewed that my proposition was by no means unwelcome. She has certainly no aversion to my conversation and company. After parting, I could not help smiling to myself and saying the flirting with this girl has done me so good. It is heavy work to live without women's society, and I would far rather while away an hour with this girl who has nothing in the world to boast but good humor than not flirt at all. If I had M, I should be very different. I'm sorry, I read that very different. If I had M, I should be very different. She has my heart, and I should want no more than her, but now I am solitary and dull.
Oh.
Always the romantic, always the dramatic, but okay, listeners, especially because I know there's some conjecture out there about like, oh, the ands, how real was the relationship? How real was the love? Spoiler, very fucking real. And I will prove it to you with copious fucking diary entries to point out the fact that there was real love there, intense, deep, fulfilling love. And that, you know, I don't know about y'all, but like if I have an argument with someone, like I write stuff after the fact, the things that I will say about that person isn't their best look.
Yeah, I get you. I get that.
I mean, I don't know if you ever vent via writing. Less is usually more. Do you vent when you write? Like, do you write as venting? Is that something you do?
Have
you journaled?
I have arguments in my head. It doesn't always make it to paper. By the time I'm writing it, I've already had it 3 times in my head. And it's less expressive because everything I wanted to get out is already gone. And if I didn't like the person, then there's nothing to really, really say. It's, you just have laurels you rest on and then you just go about your day. You go about your business.
So were you a journaler? I mean, maybe we should ask this question and answer it of ourselves.
I journal not about the downs. Like,
But like, what's your, so you saying you journal, is it like a daily, like, are you one of those daily people?
More like weekly or, you know, maybe they surround events.
Do you use an actual physical book or are you e-based?
No, I use an app.
See, that's the danger, man. And I only say that because I mean, there are many times, I mean, I love a good notebook, to be perfectly honest. There's very few times you just catch me in life without a notebook somewhere so I can write my things in, because it's kind of different to write my thoughts out than when I'm in my notepad and my iPhone, which is good for just like immediate things or business things. But sometimes creatively, it's better for me to actually use my hands and write. And when I was younger, I always had like little notebooks just when I would people watch and do other things and just want to write things down. But there was like a moment in time in, I want to say end of high school, beginning of college, where I was like, oh, let me use the computer to write my things down. And at that horrible, horrific time, I had a Dell that my mom had gotten for me. to accompany my freaking oldest shit iBook from back in the day. And wow, just thinking back on that iBook, Lord. And so I was doing that. I was trying to do the thing. And what's even worse about that is I was totally in my existential phase of like philosophy and reading and just really being self-introspective, trying to have some self-actualization going on. And you know what happened? That, well, if anyone's here has experienced Dell, especially old school Dell, it crashed. It took my data with it. It did, parents! No. If you can't tell, I'm still not over it. I freaked out, mostly because I had a short story on there that was like super important to me, and it was gone. And I completely had like just one of those unstable situations where you're like, what's going on? I'm going to break some stuff. I'm going to do some stuff. And I ended up chucking that Dell laptop out of my window, and it flew distances across the New York City street and broke into a bunch of pieces. And my mom was like, you threw your computer? You did what? You said you did what? And I was like, yeah, I'd had enough. It was just one of those frustrating things where you know you're fucked. And I'm a technically inclined person. So just from the sound the hard drive was making, I knew that I was fucked within a certain kind of way. And so the only rational thing to follow that was irrational behavior, which was breaking things and further damaging my electronics, because I was like, well, might as well go all in with the fucking bullshit. And I never bought a Dell again. That's the moral of the fucking story. Candace has only had Apple computers since then, with the odd HP or Sony Bolden. I don't know why. Yikes. I forgot. Oh, right. Journaling. Okay. There you go. So I don't think I've actually been in the habit of journaling myself, like daily. No, that's not what happens. You know what I do, but I don't even know how that works. Like, I do voice notes.
Voice notes are good. I do several.
It's not necessarily like self-introspective. I'm just sort of like, here's my thoughts. Like, if I get a creative thought, I'm like, boom, record this, dictate it to yourself so you can listen back to it later. But yeah, not the Ann Lister situation of just sort of like, I've got volume where I'm going every single day and I'm talking about what I did and who I did it with and what I felt. And I mean, now I kind of wish I could. I think in a moment I had a live journal, but I can't even tell you what that live journal name was, so I could try to go like, back in time and see what the fuck's going on. I'm sure like during the 9/11 time period, it was especially dark because I was especially dark.
Oh, I have like notes in like social media somewhere, like this Facebook thing used to have notes. It was a tab.
I never did anything on Facebook like that, which is interesting because we're now, I mean, we're millennials and we're in the age of Gen Z. And certainly how kids would journal or this process of diary keeping completely evolves with technology. And so does whether or not it could actually stay, because we have Ann Lister's writings because they're physically tangible, locked behind some fucking wall or hidden behind a wall that we could then find. But if we're talking about data streams, I mean, not only can you then create more words, like easily have 10 million words, double the size of Ann Lister if you're typing about it, but then how can we be sure that it remains, that it doesn't go away? Does it have the same appeal?
That's a cool question.
I just don't know. I mean, I think there can be something therapeutic about physically writing, as I've said, but I don't know. I'm not enough of a journaler to be like, well, I think this is better for this reason. I think typing would be easier, just effectively. Like I'm always in a rush, so I want to finish what I'm doing. And sometimes writing, I get impatient with my own self because I like to be perfectionist with my handwriting. But then to be a perfectionist, you got to write slow. But then you're sick of yourself because you're writing slow. So you're just like, fuck it. Let me type it up. I mean, I don't know.
I feel like my brain travels faster than my hand. So things come out looking chicken scratching. I mean, I like to type when I can. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So this is the journaling of the current times, of the present, for the young babies, is, as you were suggesting, like Facebooks and things like that, because Facebook, I mean, on principle with the privacy issues, probably not a good idea, but okay. But is Facebook even for Gen Zers? I feel like Facebook is for old people now at this point. And the Gen Zers are elsewhere on like Instagram or Twitter or Tumblr. Right. Yeah. But you can't. Oh, that's actually, I was about to sound like a real fool. Cause I was like, you can't journal on Tumblr. A blog site. Candace, that's the original purpose of Tumblr. Candace, what the fuck are you saying? Ay, Dios. Okay. Well, and I do like the fact that if you want to journal on Tumblr, you can put your shit out into the world and still have your anonymous thing, if that's what you want, so that you can be truly unedited and get feedback. You can just be like, here. I mean, that's why Tumblr's so gay. It's for all the baby gays who can't fully express themselves in life, can be as gay as they want to be on the Tumblrverse. But anyway, we have gone off into a tangent. I don't even know the purpose of the tangent. I blame myself.
We were asking just about journaling in general.
Right. We were inquiring about each other's journaling habits and if they existed, which seems like no. Like, well, you said weekly. So, okay. You're a weekly journaler. One of the books that I read was actually interesting because it was taken from the, written by Helena Whitbread. It was taken from the position of, I'm going to talk about Ann Lister's diaries, and I'm going to talk with this person, Natasha Holm, who also kept copious diaries, but she's from present modern times. And it was sort of like the book was formatted in a question and answer format with the two women asking each other questions about stuff. So Helena Whitbread, who's done all this research and things on Ann Lister, is like, hey, Ann Lister did this for these reasons. Why did you do this? Is it comparable why you journaled? And, you know, what did you get out of it? And how did you live? And one of the things I found super interesting was that for the journaler, she was kind of contrasted with Ann in the fact that her own queerness was repressed for a long time versus Anne's story of like, yeah, I have this societal oppression of me trying to get a wife, but in terms of my own sense of self and sense of self-worth and validation, that Anne rarely had any issues with that. She was continuously trying to figure herself out, that is for sure. But in terms of whether or not she was like, is this right? Is this natural? Is this me? Basically from the jump, she was like, yeah, this is how it's supposed to be. I love the women and the women love me. That's the way it works. It was codified by God, actually. And so all I need is a bitch to take the sacrament with me, because clearly let's just make this whole shit holy. And I can rock with that. All right. So I feel like with the journal entries here, we can end on some family drama context, and which is the line, shabby little Shibden, which I believe we said we would expand upon at a later date. And so in Nature's Domain, in the introduction, they spend some time talking about Anne and her perception of her family and her life. And one thing that I don't know if you noticed in the show, but given all the care and attention they've paid, this is obviously deliberate, is that have you noticed the difference in accents between Saran Jones, who plays Ann Lister, and Gemma Whalen, who's playing her sister, Marion, as well as her other family members and other people who might appear in Halifax?
Is that with the intent to come across to the public as being from a named family? Is that...
Well, it seems like... So we see how Anne was always traveling all over the place, and that was how she added to her air of sophistication, that, you know, traveling that often was basically unheard of for women, let alone at your own impetus. So that is something that is being done purposely in the show, because that is something that Anne had a problem with. As we mentioned in episode one, she was like, God, shabby little Shibden, my shabby little family, that she was embarrassed, essentially, of what she felt like was them bringing her down, bringing her stock down, that she'd spent so much time raising in her travels. And part of that is like her disdain for the Yorkshire accent that they still have, yeah, that she does not have, because she's so well-traveled and learned, but also it's a deliberate choice to be like, I don't want to sound like I'm from this basic ass family. I want to sound like I'm fucking refined.
At least some of the entries that basically confine themselves to episode one and don't accidentally spill over. Yeah, it's kind of hard because
like I found other entries that are irrelevant, but at the same time, it's like a spoiler. And I'm just, it's really fucked up that I've read all these books, because all I want to do is just like talk about my opinions and thoughts on things I feel like I've put together about their lives, or, you know, just ideas about how they were expressing their queerness. And I can't get there yet. So I'm doing my best to hold it together. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, if you want to put out the signal on the social meds, maybe there's someone you can tete-a-tete
with. If you too read all of the books and you want to talk about like stuff, like one of the random things I was musing about was that, you know, the fact that Anne Walker, as you'll see, there are some issues she has to deal with, both mental and physical. And one of the things where people are like, oh, she had back pain, back problem, weak spine. You know, Dr. Kenny mentions things of this nature, like people have been looking after Anne for this amount of time. And, oh, is it all in her head? Is it hysteria because her back hurts, but we can't find nothing in her back? And you know what fucking occurred to me? That I feel like could be totally relevant. And I don't know if there's a historian or anyone in the fucking scene who just this occurred to them. But pinched nerves.
Actually, that could be what
you can't
that is.
See a pinched nerve, and all of the technology relevant to helping us see pinched nerves, type of CAT scans and MRIs and magnetic fucking imaging, that's all a 20th century creation. If I'm not mistaken, the MRI was invented somewhere around 1970-ish. Don't quote me. I'm sorry. I'm not Googling, guys. But somewhere around there. And so my point is, and I think this personally occurred to me because I have dealt with stuff like that, where you're like, what's this pain coming from? What's this tingly? Why am I having this numbness? And then you go through a bunch of tests that are creepy and kind of, you know, anxiety inducing. And they're like, oh, look at this. You've got a herniated vertebrae, four discs herniated. And you're like, which is what I found out. And I was like, oh, all those years of odd positions, dancing and holding my camera in really weird ways, has I've paid the price with my herniated disc. But I say that to say that I myself, my dad had back problems when I was younger. And there's just certain things you can't see with the nerves unless you have these machines. And so everyone in the 19th fucking century and prior, including Ann Walker, had something happen to them? Had they fallen? Had they developed in a certain way? And there's a fucking pinched nerve that would cause you pain.
Yeah.
And not the kind of pain that leaves a bruise, not the kind of pain that would be easy to diagnose. Yo, maybe fucking Ann Walker has a motherfucking nerve pain and bitches need to give this girl some icy hot and a fucking break. I don't know. Icy hot does not help your nerves. I'm going to just say that, y'all. Like, that's wishful thinking on my part. But I'm just saying Ann Walker deserved better. At least she got Ann, though.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say the quacks that they surround her with look like they were
Don't talk to me about doctors of the time, church. They're so disturbing. That's another reason why I can't go to the past, because you combine the patriarchy and misogyny with old white dude doctors and you get, just think about the Horror Show. Basically, you get a new season of American Horror Story.
We
already had American Horror Story Asylum. This is just like American Horror Story Asylum. The patriarchy. So there's no women in there doing bad things. It's just men doing bad things to women who are locked up for doing stuff like, oh, did you have your period? Is this PMS? But we're actually going to call it hysteria and cut a hole in your head or pull out all your teeth.
No, yeah.
Listen.
Electroshock therapy.
Okay, but here's the thing about electroshock therapy. It doesn't become a thing until electricity becomes a thing. And while people were inventing stuff to make electricity a thing in 1832, electricity was totally not a thing until about the end there of the 1800s. And so they wasn't even doing that. They were doing the other stuff, Terrence. Yeah. Like, let me drill a hole in your head. Let me lock you over here. Let me pull all the teeth out your head. Let me just try this straight up violence, straight up sadistic violence to be like, will this fix you? Will this fix your problem? So no, medicine for women, unfortunately, up until like the 50s was so sexist and so horrible. And they would just throw women into the nutter for having emotions, having feelings, probably refusing their husband sex. Oh, she's gone mad. She thinks she has a say in whether or not we have sex. Put her in the nunnery. Or the Nutter's house. Anyway, so I think we got a nice cross selection of fangs to provide some insight into this very first episode. Do you have any closing thoughts? Do you have any closing thoughts on what we've read on Mariana, on Lady Gordon, on Vera Hobart, on...
I feel like we've gotten some prominent introductions to everyone. You get good slices of the personality, and I just can't wait to see when push comes to shove what maintains prominent and what kind of, I was going to use the term veers. I don't want to use the term
veers
anymore. What maintains
veers, not Mariana. You know what I'm saying? Like, Veer was just a straight girl trying to fucking experiment. Mariana, well, trying to, maybe thinking about it, but then she was like, oh, but a man's come along. Because I got the impression that Veer was like, I might end up alone, and then, okay, here's you, Anne, or I could end up with a man. And in that case, like she was keeping Anne around for, what do you call it? Like seconds.
Yeah.
You know, second option in case your first option doesn't work out. And that's shitty. Who wants to be someone's second
contingency
option? Who wants to be motherfucker's contingency? Not me. And certainly not Anne. What were you saying that brought up that sentence?
that well, we've gotten prominent slices of personality in the first episode, and I was looking forward to seeing when push comes to shove, if there's conflict in episode two, what maintains as far as what's been laid out for each personality, and what sort of fears under the circumstances.
We don't really, as the series goes on, we don't really get much insight into Isabella Northcliffe. And I actually really am holding out hope for series two, appearing 18 million years from now in 2021, that they will do that, because Isabella has, you know, about the same length of a friendship with Anne, to the same length of Mariana in terms of knowing each other and it being like this, you know, the opposite sort of energy where you have Anne vying or craving.
It's like a hunger or thirst or like...
thirst. Yeah, but we have Anne vying or hungering or thirst as fuck for Mariana's love, or rather Mariana's commitment, because she certainly believes she has her love at different times. And then you have Isabella basically doing the same thing. Isabella vying for some type of commitment with Anne, because she's like, hey, I would like to set up with you. I could do that. And Anne's just like, yeah, but Mariana, you know, it's not like that with you and me right now. Although there are moments when Anne is feeling shitty about herself, and she'll get a letter from Isabella and she'll be like, well, damn, could it maybe work out with me and Isabella after all? I mean, she really does care about me. She really does love me. And it's like, girl, you messy as fuck. And I did mention to you that actually, if you want to check out that movie, I can't decide if I should tell you to watch this Ann Lister movie like prior to you finishing the show or after. Part of me wants to say after, just so you could see the full absurdities of it. For you guys listening, I'm not trying to shade the actors involved. I'm sure the actors are all very competent. We saw the actress that plays Anna and Killing Eve in this film, produced by the BBC in, 2009, 2010. And they also produced a radio sort of play situation of Ann Lister. And of course, in my pilgrimage of all things Ann Lister lately, I consumed both of those. And I realized that I had endeavored to watch part of the BBC movie, but just quit it. And when I went back to it, I was like, oh, that's why I quit it. That's why I stopped watching it all those years ago, because what the fuck is this?
Oh, no.
It's just... Again, I'm not shading the actors because they were competent and fine. I'm shading the writer.
Yeah, it's and the more director. Like the way they understood the text at that time just wasn't, it wasn't, I'm going to guess it wasn't.
I think they understood the text. I just feel like, it's like what I've argued about Harriet Tubman, that you cannot do Harriet Tubman justice, or quite frankly, even Nina Simone, people who have such deep, rich parts of their life and past that you're like, you really want to get into it to get to know who this person was, in an hour and a half. And this Ann Lister movie is an hour and a half.
Oh, that's solid. That's
it's shorter than Endgame. It's shorter than Marvel's Endgame. It's not enough where life is big and as intense as Ann Lister, especially if you want to go through any of these women, from Eliza to Mariana or Isabella or Miss Barlow or Miss Brown, Lady Gordon. There's so many. And it's just sort of like...
them abridging her life and trying to make it coherent within an hour and a half time slot.
Abridging her life is the absolute word for it. So I'm going to say to all of you listeners who maybe are curious about this Ann Lister movie, if you've completed the series and you want to watch it to compare stuff, you should do that. Be prepared. Like they say in The Lion King, be prepared. It's intense, but not in the way that you're probably hoping. And if you haven't seen it and you've not seen the series yet in its entirety, I would say wait, because in order to get the full absurdity of it all, you just kind of have to know the entire story to understand how they just overlapped shit. They were just like, we're going to take these five poignant moments in her life and just have it all happen at the same time, in the same scene, in a situation that never actually happened, and the characters are going to interact and nothing makes any sense. And so I was actually grieved. The only enjoyment I really got out of that film as I watched it was Isabella Northcliffe, played by actress Susan Lynch, who plays Isabella Northcliffe. And I was more so intrigued because the person Isabella was intrigues me, because she was obviously a lesbian. She was similar to Anne in that some of her behaviors, or rather many of her behaviors, body language, whatever, expression, coded as masculine. But perhaps not masculine in the way that Anne is portrayed. Now, if anything, if I'm to go off of the movie, since we haven't had an Isabella in the show, and also what the diaries say is that Isabella was a bit rough in the way that would be deemed masculine. So I can only assume tomboy, not delicate with her handling of things. Masculine and tough, but didn't appear to be chivalrous in the, I guess I'll just use the word dignified or refined sort of way that Anne is. Like, oh, let me kiss your hand. Let me open this car door. Isabella is kind of like a drunk butch. Like, like, you know, like Boo. Boo from Orange is the New Black. That's how I feel like she was played in the movie. Mm. So I didn't mind it. I was like, she's kind of interesting. I would like to watch more stuff with her, but everything else that was happening in the story with Ann Lister and Ann Walker and Mariana, like, you must see Supreme Bitch version of Mariana. It's in that movie. Matter of fact, we should just watch it. When we're done with everything, right, all of this, like, we'll do that. We'll watch it. And hopefully the writers and producers of that production never find this podcast, because they will not be pleased is what I have to say. But I just feel like it's disrespectful. Actually, it's not even about the performances. It's about the disrespect paid to Ann Lister's life. That how dare you? How could you do that? How could you conflate so many lies? How could you do so many weird things? God, I want to tell you this thing, but it's a spoiler. So I need to stop. So let's just stop. Let's just be done. Well, friends, I hope you enjoyed this historical
nightcap.
And the little additional insights and things we had into Ann Lister's life and all her friends, her gay friends, her straight friends.
As always, you know, stay tuned and hold off for when we finally get to do episode 2 of this season. I don't want to say that we're certainly in. I don't want you to feel as though we're in a rush to get to series 2. I mean, it's not even aired yet, but.
So. Bitch, ain't no fucking rush when they said, I was under the impression they were like, that they was going to be on that Killing Eve mantra of just like, let's give the people what they want. And by the people, the Americans, because I know the Brits are used to those fucked up schedules of like fucking Luther and Fleabag. And what's the other one with dude, Cillian Murphy? Is that Peaky Blinders?
They have that. Yeah.
Yeah, Peaky Blinders. Just shows that come out and they're good. People enjoy them. And they're like, oh shit, I really like this show. And the BBC is like, oh, okay, but. We'll see you in 2 to 3 years. I mean, it's like season 1 of fucking Jessica Jones, just like forever away. And so at least we don't have to suffer like that with Killing Eve, because it's pretty sad. I guess we should mention it's pretty sad that Gentleman Jack did not
receive any of the...
Did not receive any Emmys.
Emmys for HBO.
I got a run up on someone on the Emmy goddamn committee. I mean, no, really, I thought it was going to be a tough year. I mean, we've discussed this ad nauseum as it relates to Killing Eve, just because, well, we want all of our women to win stuff. But this year in particular, as will the next, there will be super high competition in that race. I mean, Big Little Lies didn't even qualify this year. So I'm pretty sure that means it'll qualify next year, which will make that Emmy competition fraught with whoever's going up against those bitches. And Game of Thrones really kind of was annoying because it took more spots that, in my personal opinion, it should have taken. It
deserved, yeah.
One of those supporting actress spots could have gone to Sophie Rundle. Just saying. Just one of them. But, you know, it is what it is. And hopefully our Killing Eve ladies don't split the difference with their vote, because that could happen. I just want one of them to win, or really I would prefer a tie, because I don't want either of them to be upset.
Yeah, give it to them both. Is there a way to do that?
How do we do that? How do we vote that? Hopefully Fiona Shaw just comes in. Oh, she's nominated twice, by the by.
Oh, then that's great.
Yeah. So... I know you Gentleman Jack fans, or for those of you who are just starting the show to watch and listen, follow along with us, are disappointed, as we should be, because this iconic piece of queer filmmaking, TV production should be honored. But I say don't lose heart, because there are plenty of other award shows around. If the Emmys want to fuck around and fuck up where this is concerned, there's always the Golden Globes. There's, you know, IFC. There's all kinds of guild things and all kinds of things where the industry still will be recognizing people. So all is not lost. And considering how quickly that shit aired in the UK, we know the BAFTAs will be over there recognizing them. So I take heart in that. Also, Gentleman Jack did not benefit from the immense boost in popularity that Killing Eve received from Sandra Oh's sheer presence. And then the weight of the fandom and everyone who watched blowing that shit up over the past year to... create megastars of our girls. And everyone in Gentleman Jack does have a pretty decent pedigree of acting, as I've learned. But the thing is, I wasn't familiar with really any of them. Right. How about you?
No. And I'll take something offline. Wouldn't after because now I'm angry about the thing. But I don't want it to be tagged on here. But
okay.
No, as far as any of the actresses from this show, nobody I could immediately recognize.
Well, just Yara Greyjoy from Game of Thrones. Gemma.
Oh yeah. The
right. So I'm not, so there was nothing in my immediate thing. And the only reason I was aware of Saran Jones is not because I ever watched a British soap opera. I've not actually seen a previous Sally Wainwright show, but I'm curious to go back and check them out, namely for her writing, to see what she's on about, like, you know, what's this consistency look like? And also Saran Jones, because she's been in two other of her shows. But the only reason I was aware that Saran Jones existed as a lesbian, was that a Freudian slip?
Hello.
My bad. The only reason I knew Saran Jones existed as an actress was because of my Jodie Comer pilgrimage that I went on after season one of Killing Eve, where I, of course, watched Dr. Foster. And I was like, what's with this hetero propaganda? But I did like that she was a kind of on her misandry rise because she was just, you know, like, fuck my husband and fuck his cheating. But yeah, so we just don't know. And other Gemma, who plays Aunt Anne, she has a long, varied history in acting in the UK, British films, British productions, and was the same Aunt Anne in the BBC, the previous BBC film production on Ann Lister. So yeah, but that's that.
We want to thank you guys for coming on this ride with us. I mean,
yes,
it's still, you know, it's still the beginning.
So the beginning.
As soon as we get to the meat of this series, you can episode anticipate
three. Episode three. More. I mean, it's really episode two, but episode three will be when my high-pitchedness starts happening at a more frequent rate. Prepare thyselves, friends. Prepare thyselves. So you can follow us on all the things on social media to stay abreast with current Gentleman Jack Crack news and developments. We are on Instagram at Gentleman Jack Crack, on Twitter at Gentleman Crack, and on Tumblr at Gentleman Jack Crack. And if you want to send us an email, we are at gentlemanjackpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to use any of those platforms to hit us up, DM, private message, whatever. You got a question, you got a comment. You want a bitch?
Right.
About Mariana? Feels? Find me. Do yes. you want a bitch about Mariana? Please find me. I have things to say.
I know. I'm here. Something. And there's something that's on my tongue, but I'm like, that's not the show. That's not the show.
It looks like we still haven't figured out our sign off because I looked at you, looked at me. There was silence.
Yeah, I mean,
and several minutes passed. There's some laughter, and still we are nowhere further than we were 5 minutes ago. Every time I think I have something, I don't have shit.
I was about to say, do you want to drive to Halifax?
Do you want to high fly to Halifax, dear? It's not you hauling, it's high flying and the high flyer. Let's high fly together.
So it's our first nightcap. So let's close out with a toast.
Yes.
So I guess I'll cheers to a successful episode one. To Anlista, the Icarus among dodos. May she find the confidence to fly again. Very, very high. And reach her happily ever after.
Wow, your toast is so refined and adult. I'm just sort of like, here's to more lesbian longing, groveling, and thirsty Ann Walker of House Parched being ever more parched as the series goes on.
I can drink to that.
Salute.
Here, here.
All right, cue that motherfucking jaunty music.
Cue the jaunty music!
Ow! Until next time, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Regency era lesbians. Oh my God.